This is an ABC podcast.
Art is a huge therapy, especially an Indigenous man or woman. They find that art will heal and help heal, take them back onto country or whatever they're painting, and it acts as a therapy, a very good medicine for them that will help heal the mind and soul.
Victorian First Nations prisoners who are locked down in lockup express their fears and hopes through painting. And some go on to become professional artists. That's coming up on The Law Report. Hi, Damien Carrick with you. Donald Trump continues to dispute the result of the US elections and falsely claim widespread voter fraud. He says he'll press ahead with legal challenges to the voting in a number of key states. So, what are Trump's chances of success? And what happens if Trump refuses to accept the rulings of the courts? Professor Edward Foley is an expert in election law. He's based at Ohio State University. He's the author of Ballot Battles, The History of Disputed Elections in the United States. Edward Foley, if we can talk about the states individually, let's start with Pennsylvania, which seems to be the key battleground right now. The main case, as I understand it, centres on ballots that were posted by election day but could still be counted for 3 days after the election. Can you walk me through that?
Sure. And that is true. That is the main case, or has been up until today. And there's a version of it at the U.S. Supreme Court, our highest court. It doesn't seem to be that there are enough actual ballots to make a difference to the outcome of the who wins the state of Pennsylvania. And maybe because of that reason, there was a new case filed that seems to seek much broader relief, really challenging either all or almost all of the mailed ballots, the so-called absentee ballots, statewide in Pennsylvania. It's a long complaint that was filed, about 100 pages. We're just starting to get our minds around it, those of us who are studying this. So I think there was a significant development today, at least in terms of the kind of claim that President Trump is making with respect to Pennsylvania.
And what is this claim? What is his claim for all the mailed-in ballots?
It's a new claim filed in our local federal courts. And the reason why that's important is that normally litigation over the outcome of elections in America is based in our state court system, because we have, you know, our 50 states and elections are run by states. So the fact that it's in federal court, not state court, is technical but important to us, because it raises procedural questions and jurisdictional questions even before you get to the merits. The merits seem to be complaining about the argument that both absentee ballots were treated differently than in-person ballots. That seems to be a surprising claim, because sort of the very nature of vote by mail is that it's different from in-person voting. So it's hard to see how that could get traction, but they're trying to frame that as an equal protection violation. We have the Equal Protection Clause of our Constitution, and that did figure prominently in Bush versus Gore back in 2000. So maybe it's understandable if you're trying to challenge the result that you would try to frame it as an equal protection problem. But it's hard to see how just the fact that absentee ballots are treated differently than in-person ballots would itself be a problem. There also seems to be a claim that some of the absentee ballots in specific localities within the state of Pennsylvania were treated differently than the ballots of the same nature in different parts of the state. That's a kind of claim that would sound more like Bush versus Gore. Bush versus Gore didn't involve absentee ballots. It involved those so-called hanging chads that maybe some listeners have heard about, but the characterization of variation between one part of a state and another part of the state has echoes of Bush versus Gore. It's hard to see, though, that any of this is really going to get a federal court to stop the certification of the votes in Pennsylvania. That's the remedy that they're seeking. They basically want to shut the whole counting process down, and that just seems to be a very difficult remedy to ask a federal court to do.
So you don't think that this litigation has good legs in the federal courts? Assuming it gets decided either way, can it then be appealed to the Supreme Court?
It could. Yeah, absolutely. It could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Based on what I've been able to discern so far, it seems like this is a low probability of success. But one always has to be cautious with respect to constitutional claims in the United States, because there are these general principles like equal protection, and Bush versus Gore was a surprise to many people. So, but from what I can tell so far, this seems a low probability of success.
Okay, and this idea of equal protection, it means that everybody's vote needs to be treated the same way, can't be advantaged or disadvantaged. And harking back to Bush versus Gore in 2000, those hanging chads punched kind of cards, they were being processed differently in different counties. So you'd have to find some kind of analogous argument 20 years later in a totally different voting system and technology.
Correct. Correct. And just to be clear, I mean, I think the basic principle of equal protection, you know, is an important one. I mean, we do want equal citizens to have equal voting rights, but, you know, but stated that way, you know, it's overly simple, right? I mean, we do tolerate, as you say, different kinds of voting technologies. There is local variation in the administration of elections in terms of, you know, the number of polling places in a neighborhood. You know, it doesn't have to be exactly the same. We had a big issue, you maybe some listeners know, about how many drop boxes there could be in each county. And was it going to be one drop box per county, no matter how many residents each county had? So 5,000 voters would get one drop box and 5 million voters would get one drop box? Or is equality meaning that the larger county gets more drop boxes? I mean, so you can believe in an equality principle, and then figuring out exactly how it applies in details is another question. And so just because you claim some sort of inequality doesn't mean you win.
How could equal protection work if all the mailed-in ballots are disqualified? I mean, that's going to not be equal protection for all the people who send in their votes that way.
Exactly. No, I think that's a very good point. And there is another principle in American election law about reliance interests. You don't invalidate voters when they were eligible voters, entitled to participate. They were relying on the rules as it existed. You can't just trip them up if they acted innocently. So that's why the issue of remedy is an important one, as well as just the basis of the claim. So even if there was a problem, and I'm not saying that there was, it doesn't follow that the remedy is to invalidate all the votes that were already cast.
And Professor Edward Foley, we think that Trump and his supporters will have a scattergun approach. They'll lodge as many legal claims as they can around the country. Briefly, what are some of the other claims that are going to come before the courts?
Right. And the important point there is that President Trump's campaign can't be successful by focusing on a single state. You know, the way the Electoral College math works is at this moment, he would need to be successful in three different states to really jeopardize President-elect Biden's apparent victory, the ones that has been declared, you know, on behalf of Biden at this point. So not just Pennsylvania, it would have to be Pennsylvania and Georgia and Michigan. You know, there may be other states that the Trump campaign might try to put into play, but he can't win just one of them or even just two of them. And so that seems like an extra tall order. He has again today alleged, you know, widespread fraud in Michigan as another state. Again, we haven't seen the evidence to back up that claim, and the margin of victory, as it appears in Michigan, is particularly large. I mean, that's the one that Trump is the farthest behind on, so that also seems maybe the hardest to overcome. So, you know, figuring out exactly how to see the Trump strategy as ending up successful seems difficult, at least for me at this moment.
Professor Edward Foley, expert in election law at Ohio State University, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Law Report on ABC Radio National with Damien Carrick. Available anywhere, anytime, via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
3 separate legal challenges to coronavirus lockdown measures have all been thrown out by Australian courts in just 1 week. Queensland mining magnate Clive Palmer's challenge to WA's hard border closure, and 2 challenges by Victorian businesspeople aimed at their state's tough restrictions, have all failed. I'm joined by constitutional law expert UNSW Law Professor George Williams. George Williams, let's walk through each of these decisions separately. Why did Clive Palmer challenge WA's hard border, and what was his legal argument?
Well, as we know, the West Australian government introduced a special direction which said that they were introducing a hard border and you could only enter Western Australia if you were an exempt traveller. That might be the Western Australian Premier, it might be people on official business. And Clive Palmer applied to be an exempt traveller but was refused, so essentially could not cross that border. He took a case to the High Court arguing that Section 92 of the Constitution, which guarantees trade, commerce and intercourse between the states, preserved his right to enter Western Australia, and that's now been the basis of the case as it's run for several months. What we found out on Friday, very quickly after the hearing earlier in the week, is that Palmer was unsuccessful, but we've only got orders at this point, meaning we know the outcome, but we can only guess at the reasoning that got the court to that point.
Bearing in mind that the High Court has dismissed his case without yet publishing its reasons, they've clearly come to the view that this Section 92, this free trade provision in our Constitution, you can't rely on that.
Not in this case, and it sounds like an imperative. I mean, trade, commerce and intercourse between the states shall be absolutely free. You can't imagine clearer or more direct wording, but what the High Court has said over many years is it can't be as broad as it might suggest. There's got to be limitations and exemptions. It might be there's infectious fruit that has to be stopped at the border. There might be quarantine measures that are necessary. So the question in a case like this is this sort of measure justified? Is it reasonably necessary in the circumstances? And that always comes down to the evidence. And a key problem for Clive Palmer was there was fact-finding some weeks ago in the federal court. It found that there was a strong and justifiable health reason for the border closure. It found that, in fact, that West Australians would be subject to a significantly higher risk of infection if the border was opened. So when you've got that factual basis, it was always going to be very hard for Clive Palmer to win the case and to convince the High Court that in this case, this was unjustified as an exception to that normal imperative of free movement.
Now, moving on to the second case, which was kicked out the door last week, that was brought by hotelier Julian Gerner. He runs a hotel down in Sorrento, which is kind of a seaside holiday resort at the very bottom end of Port Phillip Bay. His argument was very different. What was it?
He took a case to the High Court arguing that the restrictions on Melburnians and others moving around the state breached an implied freedom of movement in the Australian Constitution. And of course, there's big restrictions upon movement. People are prevented from leaving their houses or going beyond certain radius. And
tell me about it, George. Tell me about it.
That's right, as you well know. And you can imagine why people would want to challenge it. Many people may have felt that it was unreasonable, that a very basic abdication of their liberty as a human being to be prevented from moving in this way. But it's hard to find purchase for that argument in the Australian legal system. We don't have a national Bill of Rights, so the closest that he could come to was by trying to read words into the Constitution to say that there's an implied freedom of movement that comes from the fact that we both elect our electoral representatives, our federal representatives. There's an implied freedom of political communication, so it's thought there's also an implied freedom of movement. Or perhaps it's inherent in the very idea of federation. We've come together, and how can you have a federation if you can't move freely between the states or within the states? So they were the arguments. But look, it's fair to say they were always ambitious, always a stretch. And on this occasion, quite remarkably, the court stopped the argument and on Friday decided you don't need to put this case any further. We can tell you now you've lost. The case can cease without even needing to hear from Victoria to determine the strength of their argument in reply.
Really? So they didn't even hear from the state of Victoria. They just heard from the lawyers for the hotelier and said, enough's enough. We've made up our mind.
Well, and that's right. Victoria used what's called a procedural device of a demurrer. And they filed that by way of saying, we accept all the facts that are stated. Yes, we restricted movement, but on the law, there's nothing wrong with that. There's no case. And ultimately, the High Court accepted that to say, yes, we see the restriction, but there's just no freedom of movement that the hotelier could rely upon. So in that case, there is no case. We can stop it and we don't need to proceed further. So we got a very quick decision on that one. And it both illustrates just how far governments can go at a time like this, unrestricted by the law. And also what a challenge it is. If someone does want to take a liberty-based argument, there are very few points of purchase in our constitutional legal system to say that this goes too far and my rights need to be respected.
So that case was about a constitutional argument, and it's in the Australian Constitution, this idea of implied right of movement, which the court dismissed. There was a third case which was dismissed last week, and it was under Victorian law, and we have reasons from the Victorian Supreme Court. What was the argument brought by a cafe owner and Liberal Party member, Michelle Luello, and she runs a series of businesses and cafes down on the Mornington Peninsula, again down the bottom end of Port Phillip Bay?
Well, this was to a different type of restriction. It was to the curfew.
The 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew, yes, yes, I know that one.
Yes, that's right. You know it all too well. And the argument here was not a constitutional restriction, not a freedom of movement issue, not a Section 92 issue, but that it breached some basic administrative law grounds, or most prominently, that it ran counter to the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. Now, we don't have a national Bill of Rights, but we've now got three jurisdictions, Victoria, the ACT and Queensland, which have got state-based human rights laws. There is a freedom of movement and to liberty in the Victorian Charter. And it was said, well, that needs to apply here. That needs to overturn the curfew. That argument was again unsuccessful, demonstrating even when you've got an instrument of this kind, it may not be effective in preventing governments taking actions that they think are necessary to protect the community.
What's the take-home message here? That the governments can pretty much do what they like if they mount a strong public health argument?
I think that's right. I think the biggest takeaway is if you're in the midst of a crisis, a pandemic, and you can make a clear public health case for even quite draconian measures, then it's likely the court will uphold those measures. And you can understand why. The courts understand as human beings as well that we need governments to protect the community. We need to give them some leeway. We can never be certain how effective it is. But if the courts are too interventionist at a time like this, then perhaps they'll overturn a measure that turns out to be necessary, or they'll make governments timid as opposed to taking bold action. And so there's extra leeway. If you've got a good public health rationale, the odds are that unless it's arbitrary or problematic in some other way, that the courts are likely to uphold it.
Have there been many similar style challenges in other countries, and have any of those been successful?
And in other countries, of course, you've got much greater opportunities. You have bills of rights in every democracy bar Australia, and they will quite prominently protect freedom of movement, liberty and the like. But even in those other countries, you find courts quite reluctant to actually uphold these type of arguments. And again, for the same reasons. They recognise that there's strong demand for governments to take action. And where you've got rights, they can still be limited where there's a justifiable and reasonable basis for doing so. So if you've got the medical evidence, you've got the infectious diseases experts, you're taking action in response to that, then in fact that is something that a court is likely to uphold, and to find that the normal rights that people are entitled to can be limited by exception at this critical time.
Professor George Williams, constitutional law expert at UNSW, thank you. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Available anywhere, anytime, via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Around the world, we're all coping as best we can with COVID-19 and trying to imagine a better future. In Victoria, we've seen the easing of restrictions. But for one group, prisoners, strict lockdown continues. Sean Miller is a Gamilaroi man. He's an Indigenous arts officer with The Torch, an organisation which provides support to Indigenous offenders and ex-offenders in Victoria through art, cultural and arts vocational programs. Sean Miller, welcome to The Law Report.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, tell me, what are people telling you about life inside prisons right now in lockdown?
Well, with COVID, as within community, it's brought a lot of anxiety. Not just Indigenous prisoners don't want COVID inside the jails, and as you can imagine, they're in a very close quarters with each other, and it could run through the jails at a ridiculous rate.
And of course, the big measure to make sure that that doesn't happen is no visitors are allowed into our prisons. How are people staying in contact with their families?
Yeah, so in most prisons, they have iPads where they will go along to the visit centre and sit in front of an iPad and do FaceTime. They've also got the option of phoning and writing letters as well.
Of course, everybody's missing their families, but yes. I imagine that if you're on the inside, it must be especially tough.
It is. It's very tough, and it's all your freedoms have taken away, and to have a visit, it's very good for your well-being to see your family, and if you've got children or your mum and dad, they're at least seeing them through FaceTime. You know, it's okay to have a phone conversation, but just to see them, you know, you see your kids growing and, you know, how they're coping and with the outside world there, it's a better option for them.
Now, of course, the ban on visitors extends well beyond family. It's pretty much everybody. You are a regular visitor to Victoria's prisons because you're an Indigenous arts officer and you go in and work with Indigenous offenders on their art. When was the last time you were allowed in to see your, your students, your colleagues? I don't know how you describe
them. Yeah, so I haven't been in since the beginning of the year, but we kind of got back in just around before that stage four lockdown there. We kind of got like limited visits and then it all got shut down. So there is educational like TAFEs that are still going in, other programs that aren't required as essential, as in their terms, have been stopped at the moment or have to deliver in other ways. And we found other ways of delivering our program at the moment.
You'd regularly go into, I think, all of Victoria's prisons. Tell me, what do you do when you go into prisons?
So usually we go in, they run art classes and a lot of the Kuria or Indigenous prisoners, the men and women, have what they call a Kuria art class, and we usually get along to those classes. We then can help critique work and help them. We don't give them too much in equipment, as in painting equipment or that. That's provided by the prisons, but we provide resources for their stories, for their paintings, for, you know, inspiration for their paintings, cultural needs, and have a yarn with them.
So it's about the kind of the artistic skills and what have you, but it's also about that human connection and that cultural connection.
It is. It's very much so. It's also found that art is a huge therapy, especially an Indigenous man or woman. They find that art will heal and help heal their issues, take them back onto country or whatever they're painting, and it acts as a therapy, a very good medicine for them that will help heal the mind and soul, if you know what I mean. It gives them the opportunity to learn more about their culture and continue on that journey.
And I understand you know that firsthand. Sean Miller, you are yourself a former prisoner.
Yes, so a few years back now, I was going through a very bad patch in my life and just went down the wrong track, made some very bad decisions and ended up being charged for home invasion. And that was a very bad time in my life. I've moved on and resolved those issues now and I've completely been rehabilitated. At first, I was very depressed about going to prison. It was extremely depressing. And, you know, I'd always been artistic throughout my life. I tried reading, tried doing a few things, but I found that art was just like, you know, it would really take me away from the situation I was in. I could put my feelings into my art and it really helped and resolved the anxiety and issues that I had. And then I came across Torch visiting the prisons with Kent Morris coming in and found that he was interested in my art and that piped me up and got me going. So, you know, I then found ceramic art and spent a lot of time doing ceramic art. I just felt I had a connection with clay and moulding and shaping clay. It just reminded me of my country and the carved trees and the carved grounds for ceremony that they'd have. And Kent really liked my works and exhibited them. And that went on to being picked up by the National Gallery of Victoria and a lot of private buyers that purchased my work. So it really completely changed my outlook in life that, you know, I could actually make art that other people wanted. And it was just something that I didn't think would ever happen in my life. And it really turned me around and gave me a new direction.
Is your art now a source of income for you?
It is. But then I had the opportunity through the Torch and was offered a job came up and an idea that a person that went very well in the program, deliver the program. So I had a look at this job opportunity as an Indigenous arts officer and applied for the job and got that.
That's so interesting that, you know, you spent, what, 5 years in jail. I would have thought the last thing you'd want to do is go back to jail, but that's what you do now.
That was it. And I had to think long and hard about that, and that was a very nervous step for me to take. I just thought about all our mob in there. You know, we're overrepresented in jails, and just to have the opportunity to go back and deliver the program and tell my story, it gives other people inspiration and shows that they can, turn their art into making a living and turn their life around. To get back out into community and instead of being looked at as somebody that went to jail, be somebody that's he's an artist and does this beautiful artwork and sells, you know, at exhibitions and online. And it's just something that I thought I have a passion for now, that to turn our mob around and get the numbers down inside the prisons.
Presumably, you know, a lot of it is, you know, you're critiquing people's work, you may be even helping them with the technical practice of, you know, painting or ceramics or whatever, or sculpture, but you can't do that at the moment. How are you communicating or conducting your classes during COVID?
So with our mob, we have Aboriginal wellbeing officers that work in the prison. We work very closely with them and the education. Through education, we work with the teachers and so forth. So we deliver a program through them, but we also do it through phone calls and some video conferencing. We write letters and send in art packs and so forth. Also, we can do pickups of the artworks, all without going in, doing it in a safe COVID manner. And continuing to do exhibitions, as we've got an exhibition now that goes through the 17th of December.
Dreaming of a Brighter Future, I think, is the name of it.
Brighter Future, yes.
There are some lovely images. There's one I've seen of a koala with a face mask.
Yes.
Presumably that's a totem or a spirit for one of the artists.
It is, and to put a face mask on their totem is it's amazing to see what they're thinking about the outside world at the moment. And COVID's a whole new thing for them, you know. It's hard enough being institutionalised and having to deal with money and society when you get out, but now you've got that extra virus running around.
And this Dreaming of a Brighter Future, it is made up entirely of artworks which have been made during COVID.
So, during COVID, yes.
And what are some of the themes which are coming through?
Some are COVID-related. A lot of them are about family and totems and country and dreaming about being on country, and some are bushfire related, some are Black Lives Matter related. So it's whatever they're thinking about, whatever they're dreaming about at this stage, you know, a better life, a better time for their family or being with their family. And that's what art does. It brings out those thoughts and makes you think that you can make this achievable. Yeah, so it's great to get online and have a look at the paintings, but just read the stories behind the paintings. It really gives you an insight of what that actual participant's thinking.
And what's the website?
The website is thetorch.org.au/future-dreaming is the exhibition that's currently on. But you can also just go to the shop and see other artworks there from community members that we support once they come out of prison. And we continue that support right through community. And we've got participants that have been in community now for a long time and haven't gone back to jail since they've been with the Torch. So it's a proven program that's working at the moment.
Sean Miller, a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. It's been great speaking to you.
Sean Miller, Indigenous Arts Officer with The Torch, and it's really worth taking a look. There's a link to The Torch exhibition on the Law Report homepage, and it is, of course, NAIDOC Week, where we celebrate the culture and achievements of Indigenous Australians, achievements in this case produced under very difficult circumstances. Big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Angie Grant. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.